Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever in the world you are. I hope this podcast finds you happy and healthy. Welcome to episode 17 of Stemming from Africa. My name is Cynthia Waleula. So this week's introduction will be short, just like last week, because the episode is quite long. And I want you guys to listen to all of it. And I realize I love long podcasts. Like, my favorite podcasts are like 2 hours long because I enjoy listening to people talk and express themselves and share their ideas. But I don't know if that works for everybody. And I'm trying to keep the podcast episodes under 1 hour because that seems to be what most of you like. So, yeah. So I'm having one of those weeks where it seems like it was just Friday last week and now Friday is going to be tomorrow. It literally feels like I blinked my eyes and the days have moved. It's just so fast. And a lot of it is because I'm working, and so juggling everything is just, it's a lot. So I actually don't have much in terms of highlights and thoughts for this week, but my thoughts revolve around this week's guest. So I guess this is a good time to introduce her. So this week I have Yvonne Mwangi. Yvonne is an urban planner, which was really interesting because if you live in Nairobi, we've been seeing a lot of developments, especially with regards to road building. And we have this, you know, huge expressway coming up, which I was opposed to because I go into this in the podcast, but I was opposed to because of, number one, the impact on the environment and how many just, you know, trees we saw and the drainage and all that. But also because when we saw the Thika Superhighway come up, initially there was no traffic, and then now there's just as much traffic as there was before. So it didn't make sense to me. But obviously I was saying that from the point of view of a layperson who doesn't really have much technical knowledge, but Yvonne does. And Yvonne gave so much insight into just how to deal with that and what alternatives we could use. I really enjoyed speaking to her. I think one of the things that I'm learning the most about myself in this podcast is how much I enjoy listening to other people and how much I enjoy learning from other people who have studied, you know, a certain field or are experts in their field. I really enjoy listening to them and just understanding deeper and kind of increasing the knowledge I have, but also it helps me think more critically about how things intersect and how our lives are affected by different things and how all these things come together to make our lives more difficult or easier. So I really enjoyed speaking to her. I think I'll leave it at that. I really don't have much. I just came from an 8-hour shift that was super busy. And so, yeah, this is all you're getting this week. I hope you enjoy this episode. See you on the other side.
My name is Yvonne. I'm an urban planner by profession. I was born and raised in Nairobi, Kenya, but I live in Washington, D.C. I've lived in D.C. for about 7 years. When I'm not working, I am walking around my neighborhood. I live in an old historical neighborhood with these beautiful houses. I also live near an urban forest, so I love to take time to go walking in the forest to disappear from the hustle and bustle of the city. I spend a lot of time with family here. I have lots of cousins with their kids, so that's what occupies a lot of my free time when I'm away from work.
How did you end up living and working in DC?
We can start from right when I was born and raised in Nairobi, and I went to school in Nairobi all throughout up to college. I was always a very curious child. I loved to read. I loved to learn. I wanted to know things. And I also wanted to tell you once I knew. I wanted to share, this is the word we've learned in school, or this is a fact we've learned in class. You know, I was that kind of kid. And I was also a really high-performing student. Like, you know, just those top of the class type kids. And I loved English. I loved things like history. I thought, in fact, at some point I wanted to be a writer or an archaeologist. I thought a teacher, some, I used to read a lot, so my friend's mom said I should think about being a lawyer, you know. So I wanted to do a lot of things. I've always had very broad interests. But I also loved to, like, do non-school stuff. I loved to sing. I participated in, like, church, like, choir or worship band. I used to love to draw. I used to write fiction. Like, I was a kid with a lot of interests. And the beauty of my parents is they supported all of those interests. They weren't just like, oh, you know, you have to study all the time. It was like, you express yourself, you find what you like. So, yeah, and the other privilege that I had as a kid, and I think something that really helped me in school, was that my dad had a set of World Book encyclopedias. And these, it was like, for the kids who will listen to this, pre-Google, you know, all we had was our books. And so encyclopedias had all this, like, a range of knowledge of topics. And so I would open any book, they were arranged alphabetically, and I would open any of them and just learn something. Open D and I read about dogs, dog breeds. I open P and read about planets, you know. So I think as a kid, I wasn't just exposed to learning within school. Like, I had the privilege of a resource like encyclopedias to learn more outside of school. And that just sated, like, my curiosity, you know. And that's why I thought I'd make a good teacher. I thought, hey, you know, teaching is the profession for me. But because I was such a high-performing student, I don't think there was a lot of, I don't know if anybody ever said this directly, but I don't think that people thought a high-performing student should become a teacher. There was this idea that you should do the normal things that people say, oh, you should be a doctor, you should be a lawyer, you should be an engineer. You know, like, it almost felt like teaching is something people do who didn't succeed in school, which is odd because you definitely want people who loved school or loved to teach or loved to learn to be your teachers. So I just shelved that, but I decided to use my teaching in other ways. I taught Sunday school, I volunteered, and I've continued to use that skill outside of my work, in all my other sort of extracurricular hobbies or hobby things or volunteering things. That aspect of being a teacher has been present. So when I was in high school, in Form 4, they told us, you know, hey, it's time to pick a career. And, you know, we had had no career guidance after that point. So the idea of just picking a career, like choosing what we wanted to do in university and filling out that form for the, I think, Joint Admissions Board, I had no idea what I wanted to do. In high school, I had done all the sciences because I found sciences easier than, like, home science. Like, I found, like, there was just an, like, a predictability to science, or like a sureness of, like, these are the rules of physics and, or, you know, so I found myself more comfortable with sciences. But I hadn't thought that I was going to go into a STEM career. So while we were picking, my friend picked something called environmental engineering. I was like, girl, that sounds great. That sounds really interesting. And also, it was about the time that Wangari Maathai had gotten her Nobel Peace Prize, like a couple years before that. And she was a Kenyan environmentalist. She'd won this amazing global prize for peace. So it was like this connection between the environment and, like, the quality of life of people, their freedoms, you know, their dignity, that I had never made that connection until she won that prize. So I think her winning that prize elevated environmental careers in general in Kenya. So I feel like the way that tech and startups are, like, you know, the career du jour now, back then it was like environmental stuff. That was like really the vanguard, like, you know. So I decided, hey, environmental engineering sounds good. I picked it because it was at the University of Nairobi. And I knew I wanted to go to UN. So that's kind of how I ended up with that degree. But I didn't know much about it, you know. And my other choices were, again, because we had no career guidance, my second choice was like law. I had law, I had something, you know, like very unrelated degree choices. So I got an A-, so I was able to go do environmental engineering at the University of Nairobi. And that was, I think, 2008. In between, I had, you know, had studied computer animation, you know. I had continued to do music through my church. I had obviously done, like, just computers after school, you know, that thing that we used to do. When you're done with school, you go and do computers. So that's kind of how I'd occupied my time in between high school and starting my degree. So, but by the time I got to my degree, it's funny, I still didn't know much about it. So I ended up, like when I found out there was so much math, I was like, what? Like, I had no idea what engineering was. So I'm like, there's so much mathematics. Like, guys, nobody warned me, you know? And math is not my strong point, but because I was just like a professional student. So I was good at like figuring things out. If it's not my strong point, I'll just try harder. I'll find a way to teach myself. So I managed to do it. And environmental engineering, I'll just want to let your listeners know a little bit about what it is. So environmental engineering combines natural sciences and engineering principles, one, to protect the environment from human activities, and then on the flip side, to protect people from the environment or to enhance their quality of life. So environmental engineers deal with a broad range of subjects. There's things like air quality, thinking about water, you know, making sure that water from a certain source is treated so that you can use it in your home, but also that your wastewater goes somewhere and is treated before it gets back into the environment. Things like waste management in general. So, you know, where does your trash go? Dividing the trash, recycling the trash, you know, all of that. Now, different types of trash. Now we have a lot of electronic trash. So there's environmental engineers will be thinking about, okay, what happens to these items, you know, once they're discarded. There's also aspects of compliance because we learn a lot, some law and policy as part of our degree. So, you know, creating, enforcing environmental rules for the protection of human beings and living creatures and the environment. And of course, things like climate change. Like, I mean, is there a topic that's more timely and important than climate change? And environmental engineers will be thinking about not just energy or energy sources, clean energy, renewable energy, sustainable building, things like that, sustainable transportation, but also like life cycle. They'll be thinking about that through the whole life cycle, not just for the end product. So it's a really interesting degree course to do. And there's many, many ways you can take it. People who I studied with ended up in nonprofit spaces, in advocacy. Some ended up in government. You can work for a private consulting firm. Or you can even, there are some people who went into entrepreneurship and started their own things.
How did you then get to working in DC for 7 years? Mm. And what does your current work involve?
Yeah. So when I was done with university, like I mentioned, there's a law and policy component to our degree, and I found myself quite drawn to that. So I ended up working at NEMA. That's the National Environmental Management Authority in Kenya. And it is that regulatory body, the environment regulatory body in Kenya. So I was doing that for a while, but in my, if you want to call it real life, other things were happening. So I, like I said, I grew up in the city and the city was changing rapidly. And I was like noticing, because the changes were now literally in my backyard or where my parents used to live. I think the zoning had changed. So the types of a place where it was like a low rise residential area was changing. And there was higher rise apartment buildings and commercial buildings. Which is fine. And now I even understand that that's actually more efficient and it's better for the environment than for houses to sprawl all the way endlessly, you know, into, I don't know, an endless level of counties to call that Nairobi. But anyway, so I had initially thought maybe I'll do an environmental policy master's degree. And I'd even applied for that. But because there happened to be a certain building that was being built behind where my parents used to live. This building was 20 stories tall or more. I don't know how many. Like my parents lived in, I think they're called semi-detached houses, maisonettes. In here, in America, they would call them like row houses or townhouses. So they lived in those kinds of houses. And they were two stories high. Behind them, this building was coming up. And there was a lot of issues with the process, not just the building itself. There was a lot of noise pollution because they would work late into the night to clear the area, to dig the foundation, and then to pump water out of like that pit. They dug the foundation and left it for like 3 years because I heard there was protracted legal battles over the building, the project. So when it would rain, you'd hear the mud slide off the sides of that pit and like to the bottom of it, and the house would shake. So there was like a fear that we'll also fall into that hole. Yani, it was a deep, deep, deep hole. And there wasn't a lot of information about who to contact. You know, it was just about the time when we had, you know, our 2010 constitution. So we're talking about public participation, you know. And I had also learned that in school. So I'm thinking, hey, public participation, like, how do we participate? And it was like it was like a very nominal participation. It wasn't like a serious one. So I remember trying to organize like, where is the environmental impact assessment? I want to make a comment, you know, I thought that's my right as a neighbor. I went into the DC's office in Westlands, and all my life people have told me I look younger than I am. I was like 18. Oh no, I wasn't 18, sorry. I was like 20, 22, 23. Like, at that point, I probably looked 16. So I looked even younger then. And I'm going to the district commissioner's office to start asking, where is this environmental impact assessment for this project? You know, they were like, sasa huu mtoto anataka nini? Like, they were so confused about seeing me, like, as a kid, going there and asking those questions. And, you know, I found, like, the EIA wasn't even done. At that point, they've already dug. Like, there's not even really a way to go back on the project if the, you know, to mitigate things. So it was a very disappointing experience. I remember thinking, I want to organize all my neighbors, not just the people in our estate, but like the neighbors around, and call them to, we had a church nearby, like, let's use that church hall and let's talk about this and let's organize so we can be one voice to this developer or to the government, whoever. And then somebody said, hey, you don't know who owns this building. And I was like, well, okay. Because Kenya ikona wenyewe. That took the wind out of my sails completely. And I was like, well, okay. But what it did, it made me question, who makes these decisions? and what do they base it on? Who makes decisions about what gets built where in a city? And what do they base it on? And one thing I hadn't said about my degree is that although it was environmental engineering, that was sort of a rebrand. It was initially an agricultural engineering course. So there was a lot of what we learned was geared towards rural development, agriculture, so things about irrigation, power mechanics, so think about tractors and other farm equipment, things about, you know, adding value to agricultural products. That was still very much within the degree. So there was a sense that it skewed a little bit rural, and I was not feeling like I wanted to go that direction. I wanted to remain sort of in the urban space. And then now I have this like personal crusade. And so that's what ultimately led me to look into urban planning as a career. So this time I went to Google and I Googled top planning schools in the US. And I chose the US because I wanted to get the, all through I had studied in Nairobi. So what I wanted to do was get a chance to study elsewhere and just experience education, another education system. So I Googled and I applied, and eventually I got into the Harvard Graduate School of Design at Harvard University. So urban planning really is about understanding what sort of stakeholders and forces exist within a city, and then using that understanding to like help shape the city. But it's not about, which I learned, it's not about planning for, it's about planning with. But planning, urban planning as a field in America, for example, where I studied, it has a lot of failings because there's a lot of power dynamics, racial dynamics, class dynamics. So there were people who were more worthy than others. And so their neighborhoods, the people who are deemed less worthy, like their neighborhoods were segregated or underdeveloped or, you know, or even neglected or like literally demolished for things like highways, for things, you know, other infrastructure projects. So it's sobering to think about that urban planners have the power to like have this weird power to really affect people's lives generationally in a city. And you're always balancing a lot of like the new and the old, and, you know, like you're always trying to make the best decision for a place. But often that comes with talking to people. And I think that's what was missing before in urban planning is that aspect of people being able to be the ones steering the development of their cities. So as a planner, you're looking at demographics, you're looking at the environment, you're looking at the cultural, historical attributes of a place and of people. You're thinking about the form, the way it looks, like what is there now, what's the urban built form, how is it organized. You're also thinking about who are the stakeholders, private sector, market forces, public sector, all that stuff. And then you're using that to now inform decisions about how you're going to use land and how you're going to develop it. Planners, again, are people who can work in the public sector, nonprofit, private sector, often working in like architectural and planning consulting firms. That's like a big one here. So for me, I was like, I always wanted to be of service. I couldn't really see myself wanting to work in the private sector. I'll never say never because, you know, but I didn't really want to. At that time, I didn't think I was interested in that. So I decided it's either public sector or nonprofit. I just want to do work that feels meaningful and helpful. So I ended up doing both. I did as an intern first at the DC government. I worked for 6 months. And then I needed a job that pays money because that was an unpaid internship. And then I ended up where I am right now. So that where I work is a it's a national nonprofit that advocates for more walking and biking in across America. And I've learned a lot about the benefits of walking and biking and sustainable transportation and active transportation. Things that I had never really thought about, just the broad benefits for health, the social benefits of having a space that's free where people can come together, the sort of environmental benefits, the like, you know, you're saying maybe you're replacing a car trip with walking and biking. There's just so many broad benefits, and I've learned a lot since I've been at this job. So I've been working there about 5-ish years, and that's how I ended up in DC. That's my journey so far. Yeah.
You mentioned something that I've been thinking about. So you are in Nairobi, you said in August, and I don't know if they'd started building the highway. Yeah. And bringing down the trees and yeah, the expressway and bringing down the cheese, which really broke my heart. But as somebody who works in urban planning, first of all, what's your opinion on that? And then how can we, as a country, embrace and implement more active forms of transport, more sustainable forms of transport and environmentally friendly forms of transport? I hope those are not too many questions.
Yeah. So I was in Kenya in August last summer, and I had been aware of the Nairobi Expressway project that is from, I think, Westlands to JKIA. It's part of it is an elevated expressway over an existing highway. And it's funny, when I first saw that project, because I studied urban planning in the US, the US has a history of highway projects, like I mentioned briefly, that would normally go through minority neighborhoods, so black neighborhoods, for example. The US went on like a highway building spree in the 40s, the 50s, the 60s. And now they're sort of reckoning after all those decades with what did it mean to want to build these highways into the city. Cities have really been dense areas, you know, but now you have a highway through a city, it's leading to the suburbs. So highways, I mean, work became commuting work. It wasn't like people lived where they worked. So now you have to have a car, because they are building community suburbs further and further out along the highway. So that's one of the impacts. There's, you know, like direct impacts to loss of a neighborhood, loss of, like we've seen in Nairobi, trees. And then, you know, just encouraging more driving, which means more emissions, which means more congestion. And so over the years, some of the cities have chosen to take down their elevated highways, their big highways. I studied in Boston. Boston did a project to demolish its big highway. It was called the Big Dig Project. And it took almost 20 years, like much, much longer than they thought it would take. It cost much, much more than it would than they thought it would cost. I think it was probably the most expensive highway removal project ever in U.S. history. $14 billion? Like, it cost a lot of money. But they felt like it was necessary to correct that, because the issue that Kenya is having, or at least Nairobi, is that we have a lot of traffic jams, a lot of traffic congestion. It just feels like we are not moving. So the conventional wisdom from traffic engineering, road engineering, is to add another lane, add more roads. But then there's a certain concept called induced demand, which means if you add a lane and suddenly the road feels a little bit freer, if I'm a person who was not going to drive because I know it's going to be so congested and I'd rather take a border, or, you know, or I was just going to avoid that trip altogether, now I'm going to drive because, hey, Akumbe, there's now more room for me to drive. Then all those people who were not going to drive are incentivized to drive. And so that one lane is now full again. Like, so if we look at the Thika Superhighway, it expanded. I think it was, I don't know if it was even dual carriageway at that point, but they expanded it to maybe 6 lanes, and there's still a lot of traffic congestion. The other thing that a project like the expressway does, and I think to some extent also Thika Superhighway did, they forgot that there's also cross traffic, in the sense that people will cross a road transversely, they're not just going along a road, they're going from one side of the road to the other. And the way that our roads are designed, even here in America, which is a very, they love their cars, so that's what, you know, it's a big thing for them. That's why their cities are so car centric, and they have a lot of pedestrian injuries and deaths. There's not a lot of room for cycling. So there's a lot of people walking in Kenya. If you look at the mode share, if you look at studies of how people move around in Nairobi, there's people walking. But the city is not designed for people to walk. It's not made safe for people to walk. And so the expressway is just a continuation of like that philosophy that we are just moving cars, we are not moving people. And seeing the, it's also going to like aesthetically like change the face of the city. And there's this idea that these high-tech roads are like, you know, a sign of progress. Roads are not progress. Progress is progress. And progress can look like different things. But it's about improving the quality of people's lives. So the thing with that project too is it didn't feel like they really considered other alternatives for that. If you are trying to reduce congestion, what you need to do is try and get fewer people to drive. I mean, that's really the long and short of it. So what alternatives are you providing to people? Where is your public transport? Where is your, you know, where are your bike lanes? If you don't want me to drive, then I'll be one less car if I can get from A to B safely on a bike. Like, I would rather do that, for sure. Kwanza, the weather in Nairobi is beautiful. Like, it's not like here, which is now in the negatives, what degrees. So it's a good place to bike, but there's just not that prioritization of the majority of movers in Nairobi. So I actually felt really bad with that background, you know, knowing what I knew about America, knowing what I knew about how much cities were paying to take down those elevated highways that they had going through their cities. And then seeing Kenya kind of make a mistake that American cities made 50 years ago, it just felt really disappointing. And of course, one of the things that, you know, has been an obvious loss is the trees. It's the loss of trees. Now we are adding concrete, we are adding more paved surface to the city, so that has stormwater management implications. But it also has implications for urban heat. We might have a hotter city because now we have this impervious, you know, surface that's going to bounce heat up, back up into the atmosphere. We need trees, we need greenery for our health, for our air quality, to help manage our stormwater. We need that air. We need those trees because it reduces, it cools the city down. So to see Nairobi lose that many trees in just a couple of years is so disappointing. Like, it just felt like that there's no consideration of the long term, you know. And it doesn't take 2 minutes to plant a tree. I mean, you know, like for a tree to grow to the level of the trees that we lost, you know, it takes years and years and years. Now in between, you know. So that project, you know, I'm not pro that project at all, just because I feel like we didn't even have, as Nairobi citizens, there wasn't really, as far as I understand, an opportunity for them to weigh in on this project, you know, and or to consider the different alternatives. I'll give you an example of near where I live. There's a six-lane road, which, I mean, is that's too many lanes within a city. But so they were thinking about, you know, shrinking the road a little bit so that they can create space for a bike lane. But in order to do that, there's also parking on the side of that road. So they may have to lose parking spaces. So there's been a long, like, consultative process with citizens, lots of virtual public meetings because of COVID. I got in my mailbox, you know, an invitation to the meetings, an invitation to comment, how to comment, who to contact. There's, you know, they've recorded on their website, like, here are the three alternatives, this is what they mean, so that as a neighbor or as a person with an interest, you can make a sort of informed comment, you know. But they want to hear your voice. They allowed, I think there was three alternatives, and they said most people said they want to do, like, alternative B. And that's missing in, for the most part, you know. It might exist maybe project to project, or it might be dependent on the person in holding a certain office in, let's say, in the county of Nairobi. But the actual understanding that we are planning with people and not for people is missing. It's still very top-down. It's still very much, we know what you want. We know what you should have. And I think what Kenya needs, you know, waste devolution, every county has its sort of capital. I think there's just going to be more urbanization in the country. And there just needs to be, one, more urban planners. There's just an opportunity for more people to get into those roles. There's urban planners also having a lot of forums about the kinds of city that they want online, Twitter spaces. I've seen that. Like, they're very active. So I know that that community exists. But just to encourage, like, kids who are trying to think of what they want to do, that there's huge opportunities for this career path because of the urbanization of Kenya, but also of Africa. And yeah, just a real understanding that people come first. We're not planning, the city doesn't exist for the people. Or rather, the people don't exist so that for the sake of the city. It's the opposite. Like, the city exists for people. So if we have that understanding, I think we'll be okay. Because one thing, and I won't speak like a complete authority on what specific planning laws exist or regulations in Nairobi or in other cities, but I feel like, or plans, I know Nairobi had a plan, a city plan, has actually had several, and has, I think they were doing a plan for parks, they were doing another plan, I don't know if they have like a transportation, long-range transportation plan or anything like that. But I'll say that often in Kenya, it's really rarely the regulation that's missing, although there's probably an opportunity to have better regulation. Often it's just like a character thing. And so I would hope that, you know, people of good character in those roles as well, you know, like, we need those people, because this work, that it can have, like I said, generational impacts, you know, things that those trees that were built or planted many, many years ago, while Nairobi has its own spotty issue with planning, again, it was a segregated city, it was a colonial city, so it has its own issues that need to be reckoned with, and they might have to be rectified. I think we know that there are also as much as we live with the effects of the mistakes of the past, we also live with the effects of the good decisions of the past, like planting a tree in an area that, you know, will outlive you. So I would just hope that we continue to have that, like, long view as well.
You packed so much in that answer. So many things that I've been thinking about and that have bothered me. So, like you, I'm still not pro this project because at a very basic level, aesthetically, it looks terrible. I hate that they've brought down the trees. Yeah. So, like, I used to love walking along Kenyatta Avenue, you know, from like where All Saints is down. They had these jacaranda trees that in October would like light up your world, you know, and the trees would be just be purple. You'd be purple everywhere. And now, because of part of that project, they've brought down the trees and they brought down all the trees along their highway, which was really pretty. And it just looks ugly, number one. It's made the city really dark. Now, I don't have any technical background like you, but for me, that was like a big issue. And I also felt a lot like we were not involved. So when you talked about people making decisions for us instead of with us, it really, I felt it in my bones because it really felt like somebody said, you know how when your kids, your parents would tell you, we're doing it because we're your parents and we know what's best. It really feels like that's what happens a lot of times when it comes to planning. Things just happen. And then there's no forum to ask. And if there is, it's not made public enough so that there's actual public participation. It's very minimal. And these things just happen. And you're caught unaware. Like one day you're driving and there's traffic and then somebody tells you, oh, they're bringing down the trees. And like, what? Nobody. I would have liked to weigh in on that. And it's true that the generational impact that these decisions have, it's funny because when you were talking about Boston bringing down their highway, a few days ago on Twitter, I read how other countries are also bringing down these highways and expressways because of the impact that it has on the environment. And at the time, I still thought, isn't it ironic how we're doing this with, we don't need hindsight. We can already see what has happened in other countries. We don't have to make the same mistakes. Yet here we are making the same mistakes. But like you said, I think a big part of it is that is character. It's the people who make these decisions and the way these decisions are made and who they benefit. So that really struck me. The other thing that struck me was when you talked about induced demand? And it's funny because I used to live on Thika Road. I grew up on Thika Road. And I remember in high school, I went to day school. It was just torture, you know, like leaving in the morning to go to school. It was a dual carriage at the time, just two lanes. And when they made the road, I was in school. I was in med school and I was still commuting. And I was so happy because I went from taking about an hour to get to school to taking 20 minutes to get to school. And I remember my dad told me at the time, because I was like, oh my gosh, there'll never be traffic again. And my dad said, just wait, I'm giving it 1 year and we will be back where we were, if not worse. And today, my sister, who is now in school, still has to leave home at the same time I used to leave over 10 years ago to go to school. And it's mind-blowing because it's like this was made up supposedly to decongest. But now we are at a worse place because at least then there were fewer cars. It was two lanes. Now there are like four lanes on each side, like 4 to 6 lanes. And they're full. Like if you don't leave your house by 6, you're not getting to where you're going by if you need to be there by 7, you know?
Yeah.
So even as they're putting up the expressway, I'm just like, this is just going to lead to more traffic. We're not actually decongesting. And for me, it's baffling to me because I am not in any way, shape or form a professional in that area, but I have lived and seen how expanding roads does not decongest. People just get more cars to fill the roads. So for me, it's baffling that there are professionals or or there are people who are making these policies and things who have the technical expertise and still decide to do it. Because any lay Kenyan can tell you, if you expand the road, it's just going to lead to more traffic. And so it's frustrating as somebody who wants the best for the city that they live in and the best for my children and, you know, for other generations to live in a better, cleaner, safer city with better drainage and, you know, things like that. So hearing you talk about that from your technical, educated point of view is just somebody has put into words all the things that I did not know I wanted to say about it. So there are people, there are communities who are encouraging bike riding in Nairobi.
Yeah, I was going to mention that,
My fear is that because there's no infrastructure, it's not actually, it's not an unfounded fear, is that there's been a lot of accidents and, you know, people dying. So without putting in the infrastructure for bike lanes and things like that, I don't know how possible it is. And now it's election, it's an election year, so everybody is telling us how they're going to do all these things with no plans whatsoever. They just say it. just say it. And it's I don't see anyone saying, oh, I have this person working who's going to work on this thing. Just,
It's you know, I want to give you hope. Like I said, there's communities of, some of them are professionals who are, they're organized in a way that they can provide that kind of input. I think maybe the problem might be whether the input actually affects the design or the project. Because I think one thing that I've observed here is that they're able to report back to you what, you know, this is what people said. They might even print out comments from a public meeting, like, so that you can see this, these are all the comments that were made. And then here is how we adjusted the design based on the comments that we got. So, but I've, you know, like the Architectural Association of Kenya has a town planners chapter. There's a group of, they call themselves urban enthusiasts, called Nipolitans. So they have a lot of discussions about what the city should look like. There are Critical Mass, I think was started by an urban planner. And it's just a chance for people to experience riding through the city, but in a big group, because when you're riding, a lot of times safety is in the numbers. Because, you know, cyclists are just cyclists. There's not a lot of, even in the way we teach driving, we're not taught to respect cyclists or even pedestrians, really. Like, we are just taught, this is a road sign, go here, go here, go there. But, like, prioritizing these more vulnerable road users doesn't exist in the way that we teach people to drive, or that we teach people that these are equal road users, these are not invaders, you know. But they're more vulnerable. So you as a person in a two-ton vehicle actually has more of a responsibility to be careful around these people. And then I know if you look at Nairobi, you know, there's maybe some ups and downs with that. It's clear that people have a thirst for a better city. I know in some neighborhood residents associations too, I think there's like an overall umbrella for residents associations. They make comments. So it might be easier for you to comment through them than try and do it as an individual, because it can just feel like really daunting. And yeah, when you speak in an organized way, then you're more likely to be heard than just as a single voice. So community-based organizations. And then I want to highlight in Mombasa, there's a lot of, you know, like they have their transportation. I forget his title, maybe Transportation Public Works something, or Infrastructure CES is Taufik Balala. And he seems to kind of understand that people walk in Mombasa, and he's been doing a lot of like pedestrianization projects. They have like a school zone project where they have crossing guards for kids in school. So there's good work happening, and like actually in Kenya where we can emulate from other places outside of Nairobi. So I would say don't be discouraged. There's always somebody there, you know, like there's always somebody trying to do the good work. And so what you can do is join them. Yeah. If you're at a loss and you're like, oh, I don't know. What's likely is that there's somebody doing that work, and maybe you can be an extra voice. You can be a supporter. You can participate in critical mass and just see how it feels to ride, so that you can provide an informed opinion next time, because you'll say, as a cyclist, I noticed this, you know, or I really enjoyed this, but I didn't like this part of it. So I just encourage people living in the city that there's still some ways for you to sort of join and get your voice amplified.
Thanks for that. I think a big part of the problem is feeling like you don't know where to go. So I'm glad that you highlighted some ways that we can actually participate, because it usually helps to at least have a forum where your voice is heard. It can feel like shouting into an empty space, but at least it's going somewhere. So yeah, that's helpful.
One thing before we finish, I will say just on my graduate school journey was the first time I ever had something called imposter syndrome. I know a lot of high achieving women specifically are prone to imposter syndrome. And my cousin had warned me before I went to graduate school, because he had also done a master's. You're going to go there and you're going to feel like you don't know what you're doing. You've never learned English. You've never stepped inside a school. You don't know anything. You're going to feel so dumb, but it's going to pass. And then for me, imposter syndrome and like the sort of confidence busting that happened lasted such a long time. But I think what's helped, other than, you know, like I've had quite supportive bosses, is being able to talk to younger people and mentor people. I have my advisor from graduate school is always sending people to me to ask me questions, and I'm like, hey, Kumbe, even there's something valuable I can offer to this world. And the other day I participated in an environmental leadership fellowship. It was virtual, but they have one for young, like early career people. And so I was matched with somebody who is like at the beginning of her environmental career and is considering grad school. And I think that the mentorship is just, it takes the focus away from me and what I feel is like my shortcomings. It allows me to focus on somebody else and building them up, which I've always found much easier. And it's also a way to exercise the teaching spirit that I've had throughout my life. So I really value that, even as I work through like my own, you know, building up my confidence and becoming the woman, the professional woman I was meant to be, you know. Like in the meantime, I think it's good to work with other people.
It's funny you answered that, because that was actually what I was going to ask you, is what valuable lessons you've picked up along the way. So I'm really glad you highlighted the imposter syndrome, because it's something that a lot of people fight. And I find, especially when you leave home to go to a new country, so the culture shock and then the new education system, it can really throw you off and make you feel like you don't know what you're doing. It does help to have a community of people who are like-minded or who are able to walk with you and remind you that, you know, like you're that girl. You're a bit lost, but you'll find your way, and it's normal. So, yeah. I think the last question I'm going to ask you is what you miss from home as somebody who's lived abroad for long?
Gosh, actually, I miss so many things. When I went home last year, it was the first time in 4 years. So it was like a whole different world. I love, you know, when you're home, like there's a certain sense of community and togetherness that people have in Kenya and in, you know, that doesn't exist here. It's like a very individualistic society. It's like each man for himself. And in Kenya, everything is social and together. It's like all our celebrations are together. Like everything that somebody achieves, we are all behind them. We also come together for, you know, when people are in crisis. And there are structural failures, there are structural reasons why we really need to changa if, you know, somebody is sick. But that spirit has been there before. It's just that now it had to morph into giving money for certain things. So I love that about I love that about Kenya. The weather in Nairobi is unmatched. As much as it has its moods and its ups and downs, I mean, the worst it can get is what, 12 degrees cold. Here, I'm telling you, we are eating, we are chewing winter. We are getting wind, like icy wind in our faces. So, and then in the summer, it's hot, it's sweaty, yucky. There's like no middle ground. So the weather in Nairobi is unmatched. Gosh, I just miss being there. Like I'm so proud of where I come from. And like, when I mention I'm from Kenya, everyone has a story, you know, every single person. Oh, I always wanted to go on safari, or, or, you know, like everybody has heard of Nairobi. Everybody has heard of Kenya. Oh, that's where all the runners are from. Yes, that's where we are from. Even me, I don't run, I only walk, but I claim them. So this is there's a lot to be proud of and love about Nairobi. And that's why I feel like, you know, I just want to encourage people that there's room for you to be heard, and there's room for your voice, because, you know, the people are admiring your country from outside, from far away. They wish they could be there. They wish they could live there. So yeah, and I miss my family. I miss my parents. I miss the National Museum. Although where I live, there are a lot of free museums, so that's a thing to think about. But it's like very unique to this place, Washington, D.C. Like outside of D.C., you're not going to find a free museum. Yeah, that's probably what I'd say.
Yeah, I agree. The weather in Nairobi is unmatched. I am a lover of hot weather. So any weather that is like near Nairobi, like now it's really hot. Okay, not, it's like 27 degrees. This is hot. But mm-hmm. Everybody's complaining, and I'm like, ooh. Could not want for more. So, I really love it.
We are the same degrees, except mine is Fahrenheit. So when yours is 37 degrees Celsius, mine is 37 degrees Fahrenheit. It's okay.
I hate winter.
Yeah. I think this is the first year that I think I've actually come to terms with it's going to be cold. Okay, now we make peace, you know, like we make peace. I think it's just the length of winter for me that is unbearable. It's not even that it's cold, it's just that it's cold for like 4 months. You're like, hey, by the fourth month you don't have the energy anymore. And like, seasonal depression is real, you know, because you go months and months and months. Today is a bright sunny day, but it's also, if you see there's no clouds in the sky and it's cold, I mean, you know, in winter, just know it's the coldest day. The sun is out, but it's cold, 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 like cold, cold, cold. You don't even have clouds. But if you have clouds, then there's no sunshine. Then you get seasonal depression. It's a lot.
Yeah. Okay, to wrap it up, final words for our listeners.
Wow. Honestly, you can, gosh, this is so cliche. You can do what you put your mind to. I watched the last season of Insecure, and, you know, I've always loved Issa Rae's journey, because Issa Rae, she used what she had. She started from where she was and she used what she had. Now she's at HBO. She has how many shows on that network? But in the last season, she starts a business, and in the first episode of the season, she's asked how she knew she was on the right track, and she says, I don't know. I don't know that I'm on the right track. I have no idea, and I don't know. I don't know if this will all work out. And then things happen, and then towards the end of the season, the question comes up again, how do you know if you're on the right track? And she says, well, I don't, but I'm okay with finding out. And I think for me, as somebody who loves, I love history because, you know, history has happened. So you kind of know the outcome of a thing. But taking risks hasn't always been very easy for me because I don't know how it's going to come out. And just the way she put it, that I'm okay with finding out. I felt like, wow, freed. Like, I'm okay with finding out. Whatever happens, happens. So just take those risks and be that example for younger people. I think the outreach that I did was teaching me as much as it was teaching or, you know, exposing the kids that I was, you know, reaching out to. And I'd say the last thing, just because you're in STEM doesn't mean you can't be a STEM artist, a STEM musician, or, you know, like, your hobbies are important. They keep you grounded. They help you be a more rounded person. In the time of COVID and isolation and quarantine and anxiety, like, I felt like when I was in school, I had to give up my hobbies because I had to be a serious student. This is when I was in college and grad school. But now I've kind of understood, like, there's definitely a place for just doing things for fun. And there's no, you're not trying to, you know, win any prizes. You're just doing it because it feeds your soul. So always make sure to do that. Do things that will feed your soul.
So that's the conversation I had with Yvonne. I enjoyed speaking to her. And like I said in the beginning, the most interesting part for me was just getting her very professional, educated opinion on developments in the city and how we can go about it and how maybe some of the things that we're doing now, we may regret them in future because of the impact they have on the environment as well as the way that they fuel inequity in society. So yeah, I hope you guys enjoyed listening to her. I always enjoy listening to my guests. And if you want to be a guest, you can fill in the contact form in the show notes. I always get back to you in a short time and we can schedule an online interview. We love to hear from everyone. So if you work in STEM, if you study STEM, if you're interested in STEM, if you like it, just reach out to me and I will respond and we can get the word out. So yeah, I'll leave it at that. Have a lovely, lovely weekend. See you next Friday. That will be all for this episode of Stemming from Africa. I hope you have a great weekend and I hope to see and hear from you next Friday.